This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's program, there's a change of the scheduled program. I was going to play Belgian outsider music from LPs, which I acquired at the Museum of Marginal Art in Brussels recently. But in the meantime, there has been something of an event which has caused me to change the programme. Basically, the famous filmmaker Jonas Mekas died on Wednesday, aged 96. He was born on the 24th of December, 1922, and died the 23rd of January 2019. So I thought this would be the perfect or opportune moment to revisit an interview which I did with Jonas Mekas back in 2008, helped at the time by Richard Thomas. And together we went to, Jonas Mekas was having an exhibition at the ICA. And so we went down to the Serpentine, in fact, an office up a few flights of stairs somewhere near the Albert Hall, and I interviewed Jonas Mekas there. And since then, I suppose last year it was, that Jonas came to the National Film Theatre and presented some films and launched a book, A Dance with Fred Astaire, which I have with me, and I might read an extract from that eventually. But importantly, this program is coming to you live and for free. If you like what you hear on Resonance, please do support us by setting up a regular donation. That's the best way to help us make long-term plans to maintain our community radio facilities and to support our many broadcasters, such as myself. The fundraiser starts on the 1st of February and runs until the 10th of February. And there will be numerous events and auction things, stuff to buy on eBay, all sorts of fascinating items, such as a Robert Rauschenberg poster, which I donated, and another poster for Genesis P. Orridge. And I will be screening three films on the 5th of February. If you go to the website thing, you will see there events and fundraising, auction and all that sort of stuff there. So do go and have a look at that. In the meantime, so here we go. We're going to start with this interview with Jonas Mekas, which I did in 2008. And then after that, I might read a few extracts from A Dance with Fred Astaire. Excuse the repeating theme bonging. I used to visit the cinema bookshop. It's now closed, which used to be run by someone called Fred Zettner. And I would always ask for books on avant-garde film, which he hardly ever stopped them. He never had them to start. It was always Hollywood, you know. But the section gradually expanded to maybe 20 titles. And then one day he greeted me, saying that he had been reliably informed that the correct pronunciation of Jonas Mekas was Honas Mekas.
That would be in Hungarian, yeah. But in Lithuanian it is Jonas Mekas. It's very narrow.
Yeah.
Narrow E or A.
All right.
Try.
Jonas Mekas.
Still
no.
The second.
Jonas Mekas.
Short and narrow.
Short and narrow.
Ma, not ma. Oh, ma.
Ma. Ma. It's almost like a two A's. Mekas.
Or closer.
Mekas.
You say it slow, then speed it up.
Jonas.
That's correct.
Mekas.
Now say it faster.
Jonas Mekas.
Very close.
Okay.
Very close.
Okay, good. Well, we've got that out of the way.
But you see, I became Jonas because in English, in New York, the letter J, they will never pronounce it. Always J.
Yeah,
Jo.
Yeah.
And ma, that sound does not exist, as you can see.
Yeah.
How difficult
it's quite
it
difficult.
Is.
Yeah.
So it became or Mekas or Mekas.
Yes.
And I used to, for some time I tried to correct, and then I gave up. It's
yeah.
waste of
yeah,
time.
Yeah, yeah.
It does not matter really.
No. So, film culture. America's independent motion picture magazine started in January 1955.
Yes.
Dipping into early issues, I noted a review by Jeffrey Hendricks, which savaged On the Bowery, filmed by Lionel Rogerson.
Yes.
A film which I saw for the first time
yes.
only 3 years ago, yes. but which I thought was absolutely marvellous. I mean,
yes.
it's a wonderful film.
I disagreed with him.
Yeah.
But since I had engaged him as an editor, he insisted that if I do not print it, he would resign, and I needed him.
Right.
And I thought, okay, it's a little bit controversial, but I always liked the film, and it actually, as the time goes, it's more and more important as a document of the period of the real area of New York that now does not exist anymore.
Exactly, that's right. And there's a strange mix as well of documentary
It's like in the diaristic form, like I would compare me and Boris Lehmann,
who
is also like a keeps a diary, but sort of invents himself, makes up like real stories, like it makes there is artificiality which is not real artificial, same as in On the Bowery, but it is it's real and not real.
Right. But this phase of film culture initially you weren't particularly sympathetic to the avant-garde originally.
I was
yeah?
for it, but I did not really understand it. It was just the beginning of my sort of contact with the avant-garde. I did not really understand yet what was really happening in the independent avant-garde of cinema in America. But what was happening that very moment, I was still in a sort of a heavy old European, almost pre-war, because the war, there I had no contact with almost any culture or civilization.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I'm here and something very fresh, something is happening and I don't really understand. So some of it took me I think, 2 or 3 years to really begin to really understand what it was. And then I had my St. Augustine conversion. Mm-hmm. I understood that I did not really, that I misunderstood completely what was happening in America in the arts. What helped was really meeting the artists and poets. And then, you know, I began understanding by real contact conversations and what was, that it was completely something else that was happening.
Throughout this period, you were shooting and editing your own
yes.
diary footage.
I was not really editing, I was just filming and filming.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not begin in editing until like 10 years later. Oh. I began filming immediately when I arrived in New York in late 49. I edited all that footage between 1949 and like 61, only in like 1970 or somewhere there.
Uh-huh.
In between, in 61, 62, I decided to make my first feature.
Oh,
so
yes.
I sort of put everything on the side.
Yeah.
And at that time, I was already well become. It's during the filming of my first feature, Guns of the Trees, that I began. It was my first, like, moving into narrative cinema, but at the same time, it was the end of my interest in participating in making narrative cinema.
Yeah. Yeah.
Though and my interest in, you know, as a writer, as a critic, or, you know, I was always, and also writing for the Village Voice. I was the only one, the voice who could, I was covering the avant-garde and also the narrative cinema, Nouvelle Vague, etc. But I began moving into already other forms of cinema.
I've also brought this along. This is the first...
one of the first, yes.
That's number
catalog
one.
Of Filmmakers Cooperative, yes.
This is
that
19...
was created in January 62. First we had some Xerox copies of the first catalog. This is like the second or so. Filmmakers Cooperative was like an alternative film distribution organization center, because the independents, the avant-garde, did not have an organization, distribution center of their own, dependent on two or three distributors with a very, I would call it, a narrow taste. That they accepted some, let's say bracket, accepted some of his films, but refused others. And as the time goes, one sees that they refused some of his best early work. And at that point, we decided to create our own distribution center where we control all the films that go into the distribution. It's the filmmaker decides, not the distributor.
Mm. The diary footage, Stan Brakhage said that not enough has been said about the influence of Marie Mankin
mm-hmm.
on Jonas Mekas' style of footage. Is this correct? Do you remember?
I would say that it's correct. Marie Mankin is, by the way, also of Lithuanian origin.
Really?
Yes. So we became very good friends immediately. She was second generation. She was born already in United States, but she grew up, but she still spoke Lithuanian, and she would write and sing. We used to sing Lithuanian songs together. He has very lyrical sensibility. I saw her films only those that I really admired and I think influenced me. The one that I think influenced me was called Notebook, made maybe in 60 or 61, which really, like, see, the question of influence is complex. It's more like like you see something that you want to do or you were doing yourself, but now you see it, somebody else is doing very similar thing. So you get this solidarity, this encouragement. Ah, so okay.
Yeah.
You see, so it's okay. She's doing that, and it works. So I was very really impressed with that film, and that therefore it helped me to continue and develop my own way of filming, which coincided very much with what she was doing at that moment. And of course I developed went different directions, but at that point it was very important to me. And it was very important also to Brakhage, he was the same way, he was influenced the way I was influenced by Marie Mangan. I think that the first time when I and my brother we began thinking about making a film was after seeing a post-war film by Fred Zinnemann called The Search. It's about a family, it was about displaced persons, refugees in Eastern Europe. We thought that it was, he did not have any idea, did not understand what it means to be a refugee and what it, and why the whole thing is happening, that we have to make a film and show really to what is happening and how it's happening and why, and the reasons, how you feel in exile or being a refugee. So that's what started us, and that our first notes for the script was just, and actually I later made a film called Lost. But the first idea for it came, that was already in 48, already in this displaced person camps in camp in Kassel, that we wrote with my brother the first notes for a film called Lost, four times, right. Later they reduced it to three.
The Filmmakers Distribution Center, apparently it was forced to close.
First there was Filmmakers Cooperative.
Yeah.
When Filmmakers Cooperative was created in January 62, all the avant-garde filmmakers became part of it, but some of the filmmakers who had were already beginning their first features, narrative features, some of them had already made one or two and had dreams for making more, thought that being together with the avant-garde, with those who make short experimental films, personal films, would throw some veil up on their films that they would not be attractive to commercial distributors, theaters across the country, would minimize their visibility. So they did not join. Shirley Clark, Lionel Rogozin, Molly Sanger, Billy Antonio, there are a good number of them. They thought they will, because they had bigger dreams. Then 3-4 years passed, those dreams did not realize. It was what's called a pipe dream. Because what they were making at the time, the subject matter and style and technique was still too new, too different from what was accepted as will be publicly acceptable. And they did not get financing, they did not get distribution. So around 66, they decided that maybe they made a mistake, that maybe they should have joined. And I think myself that they made a mistake. They would have joined at the beginning. Cooperative would have grown, expanded differently, and they would have received their own success, so to speak. So they created a separate branch. They still did not want to be really part, called Filmmakers Distribution Center. But they thought, we'll be now part of this Filmmakers Distribution Center. We will advertise it, we will make it visible, and people will come and rent our films, show our films. But what they discovered is that they had nobody was willing to put money into promotion or advertising. So it was sitting there, and for two years, it was sort of active and then had to be closed.
Yeah.
Went into debts, and I had to really bail them out with my own money.
Well, the report was that you it apparently left you with $80,000 of personal debt.
Yes, because they borrowed money, you see, to do some advertising and to pay, you know, the making prints, etc. And then monies were not coming in, and those who had lent money wanted to take not only them to court, but also filmmakers cooperative, because they were part of the cooperative.
Yeah.
So at that point, because I had just made something for television and received some money, so all that money went to to pay.
I've never heard that before. Yes. What did you make for television?
There was a public television program. They invited me, Richie Leacock, the poet Leroy Jones, Penny Maker, yes, I think four of us, to make like 20 minute. It was a quartet of four films.
Yeah.
So that was my, practically my only television production ever.
Right. And what was
the guy who was running, this guy Oppenheim, he liked what I was doing and he wanted to help, so he pulled me in as part of it.
And what was the subject of your section?
It was my part. The main part of it was, there were other things, but main part was Peter Beard's wedding.
So do you shoot diary Facing. Footage now? Do you
still? It's on the video.
You shoot video?
Yes.
On video. DV, mini DV?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Sort of every day, like it's still like a diary every day?
Yes, I videotape every day. But
Do you have any regrets about film? I mean,
as
happy with
it? No, I have no regrets, because I know that things move ahead. Mm-hmm. Technology has changed. First there was only 35, then 16, 8 came in. I mean, then it all was good for 110 or 20 years. I think that the new technologies come at a time when our thinking, our ways, styles of life, living change, and so we bring in new technologies that go with everything else that is changing. And we adopt and use it already to record what's happening in a different, more contemporary way. And that includes all the memories and lessons from the past, from all the other media of making moving images. The past is incorporated into the present, and it's where we move ahead.
At one time, you referred to what was called artist's film with slight disdain. You had a kind of, there was a separation, wasn't that, between the filmmaker's film and artist's film?
Really, it was not, maybe I used that term somewhere, but it's, first there is a big problem about, you know, artists.
Yes.
But some films, in a way one could group some films put in grade, that category, that are not that, like, inspiration to them comes not like from cinema. Some of, okay, take an example, Paul Sharitz. Mm-hmm. He always wanted to be a painter,
right,
and did everything to, and he was, I think, not such a bad painter, but some of the films that he did and were influenced by some ideas that came from the artists, paint, like, I don't know, Maurice, Carl André, from certain section of contemporary modern art. And it influenced some of the Stan van der Beek also wanted always to be a painter, and some of his early work are influenced, like, so they fit into galleries, and some Paul Charette's actually early films were shown in the galleries, and they looked, they fit there better somehow than in the motion picture theaters, and he preferred that. So there was, the earlier Oscar Fischinger, one could sort of make something with it, with that kind of theory.
But your own film Walden is now in Tate Modern. It has its own room, doesn't it?
Where now we are talking about something else. It's about the changing ways of distribution, about the disappearing of the public theaters, and the growth of the home screens and video distribution and systems, so that there are few like filmmakers cooperative. There were theaters, universities, colleges renting films and screening. They're not screening anymore. They are in DVDs and they're closing their film libraries. Galleries became like another place for another outlet, another possibility to show films as films, or even as on DVD. So my own films, like now, right now, this very moment, my last long film, as I was moving ahead, occasionally I saw brief glimpses of beauty. It's shown at PS1 in a room of itself for 1 month or 2 months. It's running there in a gallery situation.
Yeah.
And it's okay.
Yeah.
And that's about the only way one can show.
As film,
there are very few places in some museums, like Anthology Film Archives or Museum of Modern Art or Beaubourg, or there are very few places where these films, you will be able to see these films as films.
It's a difference, isn't it, between what you might call theatrical presentation and a kind of gallery presentation. In a gallery, the film can just run over and people can sort of come and go as they please. There's no beginning or end to the screening, as it were.
Yeah, but maybe it's one went to the theater for like a different kind of experience, and now we are able to see them more for what they really are, and out of that context of popcorn or just as films. Even when they are in video.
I wanted to ask you about this thing of out of context, because it seems to me that your approach to filmmaking and your interest in memory and perhaps the loss and maintenance of it.
No, I'm not interested in memory and maintenance of memory.
Really?
No, I'm not interested.
Why do you film
only
365 films a year?
I was mentioning abstractly that it's automatically past is incorporated in present because we inherit. We come with everything that the cinema arts have already past is in us, and whatever we do, already we do automatically with all that backlog, of history in us.
But
so I don't have to be interested. I feel I have no interest in.
You've worked as an archivist and so on.
Oh, because I want to share with my friends. That's why I created the cooperative. That's why I ran the Cinematheque and Anthology Film Archives, because I want to share. When I see a film and I like it, and there is nobody, I talk to my friends, where can I see it? So that, of course, I had to start screenings. And I want to share with others.
Okay.
And see that they don't disappear, they don't fall to dust. I want to, it's from the sense of need of to share.
I wonder if, do you feel that now that you know, you've had the rise of things like YouTube and Flickr and the sort of internet culture,
yeah,
where everyone films with, say, their phone or digital cameras,
yeah,
little moments from their lives, little non sequiturs, and then stores them on a large database remotely, like YouTube or Flickr. Mm-hmm. I wonder if really what's going on there is a sort of a deferral process, which is about not actually coming to terms with things and not taking an editorial decision. Do you think there's any truth in that?
I think people who put their work on YouTube, they also want to share. They are excited about something, or either find it funny, or there are various other reasons. They want to put it there because that's one access that is, it's so easy to, you know, and to share and put it there, and everybody can see it.
But possibly there is so much that you cannot engage with it. So, for instance, people, you know, when I took still photographs with a 35mm camera, I'd have 36 exposures, and I'd have to really think about what I do because I couldn't afford to just go and shoot. Now this camera I have with me in my pocket, probably I can take up to 300 images and up to maybe...
Yeah, but one is also realistic. One knows that, you know, you cannot put... I mean, you have other things to do and you cannot put everything on. So, or you cannot see everything that is there. And then time, as time goes, you know, things disappear and other people. And that memory will fade out because in 10 years, will be, most of it will be gone. Mm. Except those pieces that people really found something there that they wanted to keep and they transfer into their own systems, they download and share with friends. And some of it disappears as time goes also. So only those that have very intense moments of something that will remain. So I think I believe in a sense in Darwin's principle in art, as in any area, other area of life. Because if people are not interested, you can see once, twice, and have a good laugh, or and that's it. And you don't, you forget, and that will disappear. So it's okay. I don't mind that there are millions of those pieces floating, because what will remain, only what will be important to humanity, to humans, for one or other reason to keep it.
Well, that's the end of that. That was broadcast on Resonance in 2008. An interview with Jonas Mekas, who died just the other day. Can't quite remember when it was. Let me see. Yeah, he was born on the 24th of December 1922 and died the 23rd of January 2019. And that was an interview that I conducted with, along with Richard Thomas. You heard Richard Thomas's voice at the end, also asking some questions from Jonas Mekas. That was down at the Serpentine. And then last year, Jonas Mekas launched his book, A Dance with Fred Astaire, which is it's a good read. I mean, it's a really interesting book. And I'm going to read a short extract before playing another CD, which is associated with Mekas. And this was called Ouija's and Machunas Ashes and Ginsberg's Beard. And this was a sort of statement or interview or a statement from October the 6th, 2004. And so these are sort of like memoirs or notes or diaristic sort of pieces by Jonas Mekas. A headline in the New York Sun says, Veronica Lake's ashes located in an upstate antique shop. And Mekas goes on to say, this reminded me of an anecdote that I cannot restrain myself from telling you. I think it was 1974. It was a beautiful summer day. Hollis, my wife and myself thought it was a perfect day for a picnic in Central Park. So I packed my picnic basket. I was in my Italian period, so it consisted of pepperoni, Italian cheeses, Dapolito's bread and a bottle of Chianti. In brackets, it's very good on a hot summer day. After a couple of hours in the park, we decided to pay a surprise visit to our friend Cornel Kappa at the International Centre of Photography just across the street from the park. Cornel enjoyed the surprise, especially when we laid out on his office table our picnic supplies. We had a great time. I don't remember how the talk turned to Ouija. During the mid-60s, when I ran the filmmaker's Cinematheque on 41st Street, we became good friends with Ouija and his funny wife. They came very often to see films and hang around. "You must have some of his work at ICP," I said, and Kappa laughed. "His work? Not only do I have his photographs, I have his ashes. Look." And he opened his desk drawer. It was a huge old-fashioned office desk with huge drawers. It was full of the routine office drawer junk: pencils, rubber bands, pencil sharpeners, old batteries, etc. "Look, here are Ouija's ashes," and he pointed to a little urn. I didn't know where to put it, so I stuck it in the drawer. He closed the drawer and we continued our picnic. You may not find this story funny, but that afternoon we all thought it was very funny. Now, after telling you this anecdote about Ouija's ashes, I must tell you another story. I must. It's about the ashes of George Matunas. In 1997, the young people of Vilnius were celebrating Fluxus and its creator, George Matunas. Thomas Venclova, a poet who was teaching at Yale University's Slavic department, was about to visit Vilnius around that time. He decided to bring a present to the Vilnius Fluxus enthusiasts. He decided to bring George himself back to Lithuania by way of his ashes. But he faced a problem. The ashes of George Matunas, according to his wishes, were cast into the Atlantic Ocean in Greenwich, Connecticut. Venclova turned to the scientists and posed a question. "Suppose I fill up this little flask with the water from the Long Island Sound Bay. What is the probability that some of George's ashes would appear in this flask?" Professor Chikanyan of Yale's physics department came to the conclusion that yes, some atoms of George definitely had to be in that flask. As a matter of fact, millions of them. So Venclova took the flask to Vilnius, and in a special celebration, it was emptied into the Vilnelle River that runs through Vilnius, symbolic of George Matunas' return to Lithuania, his native country. So that's one of the little anecdotes which you can find in A Dance with Fred Astaire by Jonas Mekas. So I'm going to now play a CD, which seems to have been recorded in Paris, it looks like, in 2009. It's called Jonas Mekas Ovation in Paris. And it includes little extracts from Lost, and a presentation of Mekas's films. And this is, I can't quite figure out, looks like Les Editions du Bas Parleur. It was issued in an edition of 200 copies. So we'll play that, and maybe in the meantime I'll find another extract to read out from Fred Astaire.
Église ancienne du cinéma. Je n'ai rien à vous dire. Tout ce que je voulais à vous dire, c'est dans mon film. Merci, merci, merci. Et autobiographie. From desperation, from necessity, I came to film
life around me and life of my friends and my own life.
De la désespoir et de la nécessité, le besoin, je suis venu au cinéma comme à la vie, avec la vie des amis.
Because I have only little fragments of time.
Parce que je n'avais que des petits fragments de temps.
And no money.
Et pas d'argent.
All I could do when I have some short moment of time, film my friends.
Tout ce que je pouvais faire, c'est quand j'avais des petits moments de temps, au bout de temps, de filmer mes amis.
This is, of course, a very, maybe, simplistic explanation.
C'est peut-être une explication très simpliste.
There are always deeper and more mysterious reasons behind everything we do.
Il y a toujours des raisons plus profondes et plus mystérieuses derrière tout ce qu'on fait.
But I just had to do what I felt I should do, what I wanted to do. I just wanted to. I got possessed by my bollocks.
Mais il fallait que je fasse ce que je voulais faire ou ce que je sentais nécessaire de faire. Je suis devenu possédé par ma bollocks.
I am a very weak person.
Je suis quelqu'un de très faible.
It is very easy to possess me and pull me into what is around me.
Il est très facile de me posséder et de me tirailler et de tirer vers tout ce qui m'entoure.
I move. The slightest wind can move me one or other direction.
Le moindre vent peut me pousser dans une direction ou dans une autre.
It would be interesting to come to some kind of illumination on what really is exhibitionism or voyeurism. I think that we all have a little bit of voyeurism. We are all a little bit voyeurs, a little bit exhibitionists.
Ça serait intéressant d'avoir des illuminations sur ce que c'est que l'exhibitionnisme, le voyeurisme. Je pense que nous sommes tous quelque part des voyeurs et des exhibitionnistes.
But it has nothing much to do why I am. Maybe it has something to do voyeurism. What is voyeurism? Andy Warhol was very often called a voyeur. But all artists and all those artists or no artists who document one way or other life around them, they have, their material comes to them through their eyes, through the intense looking, viewing, being with it. There is no art without a voyeur.
Ça n'a rien à voir avec pourquoi je filme, ou bien peut-être un peu ça a voir avec le voyeurisme. Mais qu'est-ce que c'est que le voyeurisme? Beaucoup de gens ont dit que Warhol était un voyeur. Mais tous les artistes qui documentent la vie qui les entoure, le matériel vient vers eux à travers les yeux, les regards, être dans la vie, être avec les choses. Et il n'y aura pas d'art sans les voyeurs.
But it is more complicated. I have to. I do not film when I'm just in a new situation. I have to stay longer in that situation.
Mais c'est plus compliqué que ça. Je ne filme pas quand je suis dans une situation nouvelle. Il faut que je reste dans la situation un certain temps.
It has to, I have to begin to submerge in it. I have to begin to go through the first layer into the second layer of the reality of the situation around me, to the little things that begin to interest me and pull me into them, and I want to film them, the expressions, feelings, details.
Je dois me submerger dans les choses qui m'entourent, pénétrer dans les deuxième, troisième couches, et tous les détails de tout ce qui m'entoure me pénètrent.
And there is nothing rational about it. It's not that I want, that there is no idea, I have no ideas, I do not even rationally want to film, but I just have to film those details that I see, and I have to film them.
Mais il n'y a rien de rationnel. Je n'ai aucune idée de ce que je fais ou ce que j'ai envie de faire. Je n'ai pas envie de faire des images, mais je suis obsédé. Je n'ai pas de choix.
And I have to film them my way. Not naturalistically, but I have to overexpose, underexpose, single frame, and to condense it so that I put myself, the moment, what I feel when I see what I want to feel, I merge it with what I'm filming.
Donc, il faut que je le fasse de ma manière à moi, c'est-à-dire pas d'une manière naturelle, mais en surexposant, sous-exposant, faisant de l'image par image. Il faut que je condense tout ce qui m'entoure pour que le moment pendant lequel je filme devienne aussi le sujet de mon film.
Lost, de ce point de vue-là, est un film qui est très qui est à tournant un petit peu dans le. On voit votre façon de filmer évoluer depuis un filmage qui est un filmage au départ un peu documentaire, un peu traditionnel, et on sent petit à petit l'accoutumance à la caméra et le désir de rendre, je veux dire, dans l'instant, l'émotion que suscite la personne que vous rencontrez, avec qui vous parlez, que vous filmez.
Yes, so at the beginning of Lost, the first part, the first years, I was very influenced still by the documentary, the British documentary, the American documentary of the 30s. I was a documentary filmmaker, and later I edited that material down to the real one, two of Lost.
C'est au début de Lost, dans les premières années, j'étais très influencé toujours par le documentaire anglais, américain des années 30, et je me considérais un cinéaste documentaire. Et plus tard, bien d'années plus tard, j'ai remonté et j'ai trouvé une autre manière.
But the more I, but at the same time, you see, when I come from this old mother Europe, and before I arrived in New York, late 1949, I had not seen a single avant-garde experimental film. I had seen only Hollywood movies brought to the displaced person camps by the United States Army, Tarzan, and etc.
Donc, je viens de Europe, de la vieille mère Europe, et que quand je suis arrivé à New York en 1949, je n'avais jamais vu de film d'avant-garde ou expérimental. Je n'avais vu uniquement que les films hollywoodiens qui étaient amenés dans les camps de personnes déplacées en Europe par l'armée américaine, Tarzan, etc.
So I thought that that was what cinema was. Until I came to New York and saw the 20s French, German, avant-garde, Dadaists, Surrealists, Cocteau, and the emerging American avant-garde cinema that was already emerging from San Francisco and New York, and it changed my attitude, understanding of cinema completely, and my language of cinema begins to change.
Donc, quand je suis arrivé à New York, pour moi, c'était ça le cinéma, ces films hollywoodiens. Les films des années 20, français, allemands, le dada, le surréalisme, les films de Cocteau, et toute l'avant-garde américaine qui était en train d'émerger à l'époque de San Francisco, de New York, ça a changé complètement mon attitude et ma compréhension, et c'est ça qui a changé mon langage cinématographique à moi.
It is right and not right, because I wanted to meet Hans Richter, so the only way to meet him was I wrote him a letter that I would like to become a student, but I have no money. So he wrote me back immediately, just come. So I came, but he was not teaching that semester at all. There were all kinds of Hollywood people teaching cinema. So, but I met, you know, people, yes, the other students, and I met Hans Richter, but I was not of his student. We became friends, though.
Can I ask the second part of my question? I would like to find out if Richter had any kind of influence on you and on this type of cinema, which is very different. And I ask this question because Richter was a former Dadaist and a friend or even a member of the Surrealist group.
Of course, Hans Richter was only one of a dozen of the Dadaist Surrealists who made films, and those films we could see in New York at the Museum of Modern Art, and all those films, of course, inspired us. I would not say I would not use the word influenced, but I think they inspired all of us. So of course Hans Richter was one of the and Leger and Duchamp and Man Ray and Dulac. He was one of the people that inspired us. I have been inspired and influenced by every book I have read, by every movie I have seen, by every person I have met and spoken to. I'm very open to all. I mean, I am not a stone. We are all being influenced absolutely by everything, every moment we live. But you see, that is why I'm separating influence from inspiration. I'm influenced by everything, but I'm inspired only by very few filmmakers, very few films, and my friends. Most of the time, I'm mostly inspired by my friends.
C'est pour ça que je fais distinction entre inspiration et influence, parce que je suis influencé partout.
You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com. And today's programme was a slight change from that scheduled, owing to the passing away of Jonas Mekas on Wednesday. And this last interview you've been listening to was in Paris, and it was issued on a limited edition CD called Jonas Mekas, Ovation in Paris, by the Archives Sonores de Cinéma. I've got time just to read a short extract from A Dance with Fred Astaire by Jonas Mekas, which was published in 2017. It's called On Happiness, and it was written in 1974. Dear Jane, you asked what makes me happy. I have been thinking about it. Of course, it changes. Usually it makes me always happy, very happy, to be in nature. Among the trees, to lie down under a tree or in the field, to lie down on my back and follow the clouds. No product of man, no artifact of culture has ever made me as happy. Then I am very happy to be with 3, 4, maybe 5 friends and have something to eat and something to drink and then just talk and do nothing, fool around. No serious talk, only friends' nonsense talk of 4 or 5 friends who have said everything to each other, discussed everything. And now they can put it all on the shelf and just be themselves. I remember such happy evenings with Peter Kubelka and P. Adam Sitney and Raymond Abraham and Nietzsche and Leo Adams. I am happy when I am walking the streets of New York, alone and by myself. I am walking slowly and with no particular plan and with no purpose. I am just walking. Sometimes I stop and maybe I film something. The first thing I do when I come back from distant journeys, I drop everything, and no matter what hour of the day, I go out and I walk through the city streets. It makes me feel so good. So those are the words of Jonas Mekas from A Dance with Fred Astaire. And we'll play out with a bit more of the tape, the Ovation in Paris.
En voix off que vous faites, et je voulais savoir si vous les écrivez avant.
I never write any commentaire. Mes commentaires, c'est après, pendant le montage. Et jamais écrit, mais j'ai un magnétophone et je parle pendant le montage.
En regardant les images?
Oui.
Oui,
je vois les images et après je parle pour moi. C'est pour vous. C'est une improvisation. Jamais écrit.
Le rapport au langage, en fait, ça doit être difficile. Quand on arrive étranger, vous ne parliez pas anglais quand vous êtes arrivé aux États-Unis.
I spoke a little bit same as I'm speaking a little bit French. Should I tell my funny story about the language? You will, I hope, translate. I grew up in Lithuania, in a small village that had its own practically not language but dialect. When I began going to the school, primary school, I had to learn, and I learned the official literary Lithuanian language.
Quand j'agrandissais dans mon petit village en Lituanie, je parlais un dialecte qui était propre au village. Et arrivé pour la première fois à l'école, il fallait que j'apprenne un autre langage, un dialecte officiel de l'intérieur de la Lituanie.
Then the Russian, the Soviets came into Lithuania. I went to the gymnasium and I had to learn French and Latin, and I learned some French and some Latin. Then the Russians came, the Soviets came, and said, French no good, Latin no good, Russian is good. So I began learning Russian.
Puis, arrivé au gymnase, il fallait apprendre le français et le latin. Et puis après, les Russes, les Soviétiques arrivent en disant que le français n'est pas bon, le latin non plus. Il faut apprendre le russe est bon.
A year later, Germans come. And Germans say, Russian no good, German is good. So I began learning.
You're now listening to Resonance.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.